It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Open enrollment is underway through the Affordable Care Act Health Insurance Marketplace.
Last year, a record-setting 254,000 Wisconsinites signed up for health insurance plans on the exchange during this period.
But according to the most recent State Health Department survey from 2022, more than 380,000 Wisconsin residents lack health coverage for at least part of the year.
Julie Appleby covers all aspects of health insurance. A senior correspondent at KFF Health News joins us now to talk about coverage through the Affordable Care Act and new developments in this open enrollment period. Julie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's first get to the basics here. How long does the open enrollment period go, and when will their health insurance coverage start when you purchase a plan?
Yeah, great question. So open enrollment in most states, including Wisconsin, started on November 1st and it goes through January 15th. But if you want coverage that starts on January 1, which most people do because it's kind of like a calendar year thing, you need to sign up by December 15th.
At the Affordable Care Act, it allows a variety of plans with different levels of coverage. How do people know what's the right amount of coverage for them?
Right. This is a really individual question, and it's super complex, right? There's four different sort of metal tiers from bronze to platinum, and there's, silver and gold in between. So it can be a very complicated decision. What a lot of experts say is that people should go on healthcare.gov. You can use the tools on there to enter in your information. There's different calculators. You can try to figure out how often you use care, what's your deductible going to be, what's your premium, and not to look just at the premium, but really consider those deductibles and co-payments that you've got to make when you go to the doctor or hospital. A lot of people these days turn to a broker or some other kind of assister to get help in sorting these things out. And if you don't have one, you can go on the healthcare.gov website, which is the official federal marketplace that Wisconsin uses. And there's a little button on there you can click that says find local help. Mm-hmm. And you can put in your zip code, for example. And then there's a couple of different kinds of help. You can have somebody either contact you, or you can just get a list of places that you can contact. And these could be brokers that are helping you buy insurance, or they could be something called assisters or navigators, which are non-commission paid folks that are certified and trained to help people sort through some of this complexity. And again, you can find the names or organizations that are offering those services in your area by using the Find Local Help button on healthcare.gov.
Right, because Wisconsin launched a healthcare navigator program in 2020. It's called WisCovered. Do you find that these programs are helpful?
I think a lot of people say that they are helpful. To be fair, I think right now, most of the active enrollments that happen nationwide are done through brokers, but a lot of people use the navigators, and they are a free service. There's no charge to people for using them, and they can help you sort through some of these questions.
So in terms of the independent brokers, why would you go to a broker if you're confused by insurance offerings, and what does the broker get out of it?
The broker will probably sit down and talk with you about, what kind of medical care are you using? How often do you go? Do you take specific drugs? Do you want specific doctors in your network? All of these things you could try to research yourself for sure on healthcare.gov and going through that. But it's just a way to help people narrow down the choices. And I was just looking up, Wisconsin has about 13 insurers, which is higher than the national average. So in addition to the four different types of metal levels, there's 13 different insurers. So you're faced with an array of choices. So a broker sits down and talks with people about that. They can walk them through the application process. They can fill out the application. And then when you're on that application process, it determines based on your income whether you qualify for a premium subsidy, and most people do. Now, the brokers, consumers don't pay the brokers. The brokers are paid by the insurers, and they get a commission, which it varies, but on average, I'm told it's about $25 a month per person that they enroll. So it's not a huge amount, but that's the commission that they make. And again, it's paid by the insurer. It doesn't affect people's premium costs.
Julie, young people can continue getting health coverage through their parents until they turn 26. What advice do you have for someone shopping for health insurance for the first time?
Again, I think that people really need to sit down and really think about their healthcare usage, where what doctors and hospitals they want in their network. They should check that. You can do that on through healthcare.gov. You can click through and try to find the networks. Young people are going to have lower prices because the premiums are set based on an age range. So under the Affordable Care Act, insurers can charge older people up to three times more than younger people. So the premiums are going to be lower for younger people. And if their income is lower, they also get a bigger subsidy. So all of those things combined, many, many people right now have zero premium plans. They don't pay a lot. But again, watch those deductibles. Some of them are could be quite high. So people have to compare that across plans.
Julie Appleby with us, senior correspondent at KFF Health News, as we talk about the open enrollment period underway through the Affordable Care Act marketplace, new developments, and with purchasing these health insurance plans. Julie, let's talk about these enhanced subsidies. They're set to expire for health coverage at the end of 2025 unless lawmakers renew them. And the ACA's enhanced subsidies help low-income people afford health plans. You mentioned zero premium coverage qualifying for that. With the re-election of President Trump, who's historically opposed the Affordable Care Act, what do you expect to happen with these subsidies?
First of all, let's just say for 2025, nothing's going to happen. So 2025, people who are enrolling now for their plans and picking, choosing plans that start, in January or a little bit later in the year, those plans and the premium costs and the subsidies connected with them are not going to change for the plan year, unless their income changes. If they have a substantial increase or decrease in their incomes, they're supposed to report that, and that could affect their subsidy amount. But again, the 2025 subsidies won't change, but most people do expect that the discussion around these enhanced subsidies will be a big deal in the next Congress. Let's just back up a little bit. These subsidies were put in place under during the COVID era through the American Rescue Plan and the Inflation Reduction Act. They basically provide additional percentage subsidies to folks who are at the lower end of the income, and it lifted the upper income cap. So a lot more middle income people qualify for them. So a family of three making more than four times the federal poverty level, which this year was around $103,280 for a family of three, would still qualify for some level of subsidy, but only after they pay about 8.5% of their household income. So those are the subsidies. The subsidies have helped most people, the vast majority of people. In fact, something like 20.1 million people who are covered this year get these enhanced subsidies. So the big question is going to be what is Congress going to do about whether or not they renew them? These are costly. It's something like $335 billion over 10 years. So any discussion of trying to offset other tax cuts is going to come up with, well, we're going to get the money, and this is also going to be expensive. So will this continue or not? That's a big question. But right now, the subsidies are estimated by KFF to lower premiums for folks by about 44% on average around the country. So it's a lot. And in Wisconsin, if the subsidies expire, there are some estimates that say it could raise premiums by about 85% in 2026. So this could be a huge discussion politically in the coming year.
Keeping an eye on that. Scams have been reported where people are switched from one plan to another without giving permission. How big of a problem is this?
We've been writing about this all year, and there's been about 250,000 or so complaints about this year. People get enrolled without their express permission. The regulators have cracked down a little bit. They are now requiring, in some cases, that if the change is going to be made to an existing policy, or somebody's going to be enrolled in a different plan for some reason, and there's an agent that's affiliated with that plan, but the person comes in and wants to use a different agent, or a different agent calls in and says they want to do it, they have to do a three-way call now with the consumer, their agent, and the healthcare.gov, just to make sure that consumer really does want to change their plan. So this could perhaps slow things down a little bit in the enrollment process for some people this year. So agents are telling me that, don't wait till the last minute to sign up. Get in touch with your agent, especially if you want to make some changes, because you might have to do a three-way call. But I'm not hearing a lot of complaints yet that of a long time delay, but this is something they're trying to thwart because it's been a problem for folks when they suddenly find out they're not enrolled in the plan they thought they were in and they've been switched to something else.
You've also looked into how consumers are pursued on social media with misleading ads promising government subsidies. What do you find there?
Yeah, that's sort of linked to this same situation. There's a lot of ads out there, and maybe they've cut back a little bit now, but advertising things that may be sounding just a little too good to be true. Things like, oh, you can get a $6,400 a month credit to help you buy groceries and gas and that kind of thing. That's just not correct. Nobody's getting money like that for everyday expenses. What those might be are the subsidies we just spoke about, but people don't get those subsidies directly. They go to the insurer. So just the health experts I spoke to say, just be very cautious when you see some of these ads like this online. If somebody reaches out to you and offers you some kind of a gift card or something like that, but they want your information about your income or your coverage, be very cautious. Don't click on these ads. Go to healthcare.gov. Even Googling Obamacare or Googling ACA plans might not pull up the correct website. So always go to healthcare.gov and start there and looking for coverage. So that's those are some of the concerns that people have about switching and just being very careful with responding to some of these ads or telephone calls that you get.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for the tips. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Julie Appleby is a senior correspondent at KFF Health News, reporting on all aspects of health insurance. We've been talking about the open enrollment period on healthcare.gov that is underway, and it runs through January 15th.
Meet Wisconsin's court-appointed special advocates who help kids who've experienced neglect or abuse.
They're really an important and key part of kind of our boots on the ground, ensuring that the children in need are supported.
That's coming up on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Verrett. For abused and neglected children in Wisconsin who live under the protection of courts and the child welfare system, what does their support system look like?
One source of advocacy is the statewide network of court-appointed special advocates, or CASA.
A judge appoints these qualified adult volunteers to help advocate for children in foster care. Make sure somebody's protecting their rights to safe treatment and dignity.
We're going to learn more about what these CASA offices do and what the future could hold in places like Marinette County, where the local office faces cuts in the county budget.
Melissa Skalecki is executive director of the Wisconsin CASA Association, which supports these CASA offices and volunteers around the state. Melissa, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, Rob. Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, CASA volunteers are doing important work, but it might be, I think, invisible to a lot of us out in the community. Can you dig into the sorts of things that CASA volunteers are doing in this role?
Yes, absolutely. So, and just to clarify, CASA, that stands for our court-appointed special advocates. Mm-hmm. And these are individuals from really all walks of life that are interested in supporting children that are currently in our child welfare system and just really want to be there for them and really speak for their best interests. So our volunteers are unique in the sense that, you know, they're certainly onboarded and trained by our local program staff. And, you know, we do everything to make and ensure that, you know, the national standards are met, but they're really an important and key part of kind of our boots on the ground and ensuring that the children in need are supported.
And let's talk about those children. What kind of kids would be in situations that might need this kind of help?
Sure. So typically these are children that have suffered some trauma, typically related to abuse or neglect, and are now under the supervision of the court. And a judge is then appointing a CASA, a court-appointed special advocate volunteer, to work with the child and support their best interests through really the life of their case.
And what then would that volunteer be doing? Would they be going to, I don't know, court appointments, or what do they do on a practical level?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So our advocates typically spend about an hour a week with the child. Sometimes that's a sibling group. But for at least an hour a week, they are meeting face-to-face with the child, talking with them, getting to understand kind of their wants and wishes, also observing the environment and really just creating what then turns into a report that is submitted to the judge on a monthly basis that really outlines kind of the observations, the child's wishes and what their needs are, and also recommendations for what best kind of outlook and supports that maybe the child needs, really to ultimately find a permanent and safe home to live in. And a lot of times that is with their family. Sometimes that is within foster care, but our advocates meet regularly face-to-face, really get an understanding of the child and also the family dynamics, and make those recommendations and serve as kind of best interest advocacy on the child's behalf.
And it might sound intimidating for some, well, for me, I'll say that, being involved in this very delicate situation and worried that I'm making a decision that's going to affect this child's life. But hang on, that volunteer isn't the one that makes the decision. They're gathering information. They're getting some of the kid's perspective on this that goes into making that decision. Do I have that right?
Correct. I mean, our advocates are really a friend of the court, and they are there to provide additional information to the judge and to others that are involved in that group. But really, it's a recommendation and observations that just lead to hopefully the best decisions being made possible. And they're certainly, yes, it is. They're certainly not alone. It is. It's something that they work hard to really just provide information to the court.
And you said people come from all walks of life. I might think, okay, I'm a parent, so I know something, but I'm not an expert on kids. I'm not a lawyer, right? What kind of people are you looking for, though, who would go in and fulfill this role?
Sure. I think that a lot of our volunteers, I mean, it really spans kind of the spectrum. We have, young adults that are just interested in giving back and supporting children that are in need. We have current working professionals that have some experience, whether it's in law enforcement, education, health providers that just feel like they want to donate some of their time to help a child. And we have individuals that are retired that really just, again, support the mission and wanting to support our children. All of those are accepted. And, it's really a great opportunity if you want to give back to children in need within your local community.
And then what kind of training do those volunteers get?
Yeah, so our volunteers receive about 30 hours of training before they are assigned to children and to a case. They're also supervised by a coordinator that is a staff that's paid through the program to help and support them. But they certainly receive training initially and then ongoing training throughout each of their years that they're working with CASA.
We are talking about court-appointed special advocates for children in Wisconsin's various systems related to kids. Melissa Skalecki is with us from the Wisconsin CASA Association. That's CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates. I want to talk about the state of CASAs around the state. Melissa, we've got a lot of counties, 72 of them. And CASA, your organization isn't working with organizations in every county, at least not yet. What's the state of getting these in more and more parts of the state?
Sure, absolutely. So currently we have 11 programs that serve 15 counties out of the 72 in Wisconsin. On average, annually, right now, we're serving about 950 children through about 550 or so advocates. Our goal is to continue to work with our state legislatures and to increase and expand CASA programs into counties that currently don't have a CASA. It is certainly a long process to get into new counties and working with our health and human services, our judicial branches, but there's always a lot of interest. And it's certainly a need throughout the communities. And generally, when we start a new program, it comes from outreach from just individual community members that say, gosh, I either had an experience or someone that I know had an experience. How could we help? What could CASA do? And those are the types of things that trigger a conversation within that county to see what the need is and how CASA could potentially be available to serve those children that aren't currently served or have a CASA available to them.
What happens in a county where there isn't this CASA program in place? What does that mean for the kids?
So for the kids, it's difficult. It is, you know, again, the mission of the CASA program is to really provide that child's voice. So typically there are other individuals involved. Certainly if there's a guardian ad litem, that's person that's assigned to a child's case. But we all know, I mean, the system, it is a high volume of cases and children that need to be served, and one person or a couple of people can't do it all. So our CASAs really provide kind of an additional level of support and information and feedback to all of the groups that and individuals that are working with a child, and then certainly to the judge. But we really looked at ourselves as an extension of and a voice for the child, at least to be able to provide that recommendation to the court and better support our children.
You mentioned how many kids you serve or that CASA serve around the state. Do we have a sense of how many kids could benefit from an advocate like this who aren't getting that right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a little sad, but even within the current CASA counties where we have a program, there's still about 2,000 children that are on a wait list or that would be eligible for a CASA but haven't been able to be assigned. And then statewide, there's another 5,000 children that would on average be eligible for a CASA that they don't have that available in their county. So there's a great need to further develop and support our CASA programs to support these children that are eligible for services and definitely need a voice.
I want to talk about funding a little bit. These are volunteers, but not everything here is going to be free, obviously. There's going to be training and other expenses. Where does money come from? Who pays for this?
Sure. So our funding, and because each of our CASA programs are either independent 501c3 nonprofit organizations, or they're operating under a larger umbrella organization. But the funding is, as it is with nonprofits, it changes. So nothing is truly a guarantee. We rely mostly on donors, on various grants. There's some state funding that's available, or through the state organization like Wisconsin CASA, we provide pass-through funding. But it's always a continuous kind of plea to the community as well to be aware and if or when there's an opportunity to either support in any way the CASA program, that we're always interested in having that conversation. But we have, and the majority of our our folks that are kind of boots on the ground, our advocates, they're volunteers. But it also takes a paid staff person to support and coordinate those volunteer efforts, and then certainly to just oversee the entire program.
And we saw one thing that caught our eye is in Marinette County and Menominee County. There's a combined group there crossing state borders, Wisconsin into Michigan. A chance that it looks like the CASA office there might be cut out of its current funding in the Marinette County budget. What would you say to make the case that, hey, even in tough budget times, counties should take a look at funding, at trying to fund these CASA outfits?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, when it comes to the county funding, so when we start a new program, many times it is, you know, the county is in support of that. And there's a line item in the budget that supports CASAs. However, you know, the CASA program gets established and continues on. But, you know, as with a county budget or any budget, things change. And what's available and what the needs are in any county or community, those things change and they always have to be evaluated. So certainly, you know, specific to Marinette County, it's unfortunate that the funding through the county is not going to be there in this next year in 2025. But really, you know, this is where the network comes into play and the resources that we have available that, you know, we're working on. What are the other options? I mean, I think there always has to be a contingency plan, a plan B, and this is where we come together as programs and, you know, state CASA organizations, and we figure out, you know, how can we support and what new opportunities maybe that we haven't considered in the past are things that we now need to look at to kind of fill that loss and that funding gap.
I understand Marathon County is one of your most recent additions to CASA. Can you talk a little bit about that and what it took to make that a reality?
Sure. So yes, we are so excited that Marathon County is up and running. They had their first swearing in of their first group of advocates in January, are serving children and continuing to onboard and train new advocates there. I think we have a strong leadership group or executive director with Christy Keel there that's very involved and great community support. So we're excited. It typically takes about 2 years to start a new program. So it's not something that happens overnight, but we're happy to have that program new in Marathon County. And it's also beneficial when we look at, you know, the location. Marathon is central Wisconsin. So our goal as kind of a state organization is to be able to build on current programs and regionalize those to expand to new counties. So what we have done in Marathon County and the ability to serve those children, we hope that then can be expanded to other central Wisconsin counties.
Now, suppose somebody's listening and they work in, courts or with kids or social services, what have you. They look around and say, hey, wait a minute, we don't have this in our county. How do they start the ball rolling? What do they do to take that first step on the road to trying to bring this into their county?
If there are questions, and these do happen frequently, if there's an interest and someone hears CASA and they think, God, is it in my county? Is it not? What can we do? I strongly encourage that folks go out to the Wisconsin CASA website. There's a lot of information there on currently where we have local programs and what we do. And then there's also an email link there that connects back to me that, you know, if you just want to make an inquiry and see how possibly CASA could come to your county if it's not already there, to certainly do that, because a lot of times that's where these things start. And then we engage in that conversation and kind of understand the status. And, you know, there's always a needs assessment and we work through all of that, but certainly visiting the Wisconsin CASA website is a great resource to at least get things started.
And let's bring things home by bringing it back to the kids. What do we know about the benefits for kids, as you said, often in traumatic situations when they do have that CASA volunteer, that advocate working with them?
Absolutely. And I think it is very much kind of a multiple disciplinary team of our advocates, certainly, and of most importance, work with the children and want to hear what they have to say and how they're feeling. But that then extends to their schools, their medical or healthcare professionals, any mental health professionals, other groups that those children are involved in. And it's really a coordination of efforts to understand kind of the whole picture of the child and to really work through that to then make those recommendations and what the child really wants or what they're looking for. So our advocates work with a lot of different groups and people that are involved with their lives currently, or maybe are making recommendations for other supports. But it's a crucial piece of connecting all of the dots, ultimately to benefit and what's in the best interest and welfare of the child.
Melissa, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your work with us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you for your time to chat.
That was Melissa Skalecki from the Wisconsin CASA Association. We've been talking about the work that court-appointed special advocates do to advocate for children in the child welfare system here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, a new play brings a whodunit mystery to a Wisconsin supper club and tries to bring people together.
It's about being in community with each other, and it's about taking care of the people you love.
That's up next here on Wisconsin Today.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an old, unique family heirloom.
Many people preserve their genealogy through family trees, mapping the branches and roots out on paper. Hee-Won Lim brings us the story of a unique geological work of art, a Norwegian plaque. It's part of the Wisconsin 101 collection, which tells the history of the state through objects.
In 1879, Hans Gunther Magelsen of Norway commissioned a jeweler in Oslo to create a gift for his granddaughter-in-law, Sarah Magelsen. The gift was a round wooden plaque inset with a 5-øre coin, the equivalent of a nickel. Surrounding the coin are 18 circles of names and important dates chronicling the Magelsen family genealogy. The dates note births, marriages, and when people emigrated to the United States. Dana Kelly is the executive director at the Norwegian American Genealogical Center and Nazeth Library. She says this plate is a one-of-a-kind genealogical artifact.
The things that they brought with them were pretty utilitarian, but to have just an artistic object like this was pretty unusual.
Kelly says the center sees other genealogical objects, such as trunks with names painted inside the lid or family Bibles, where a family has several generations of baptisms and marriages recorded.
But obviously a Bible's not created just for genealogy. It's meant to be a book. So this is unique in that respect, that it was created specifically for genealogy to tell the family's history.
Certain names on the plate are underlined over and over, which was a practice used in church records back in Norway. The Magelsens had ministers in the family tree, so they likely carried on this practice for generations.
You know, I baptized so-and-so's daughter, you know, Kari. He would underline Kari's name because that was the important part. That was the child being baptized. It does kind of look like they're doing that here, underlining the person's name to accentuate who's the important person on this line. So they're keeping with that custom.
The plate begins with a different Hans Gunther Magelsen, who was born in Hamburg, Germany in 1734 and emigrated to Norway in 1756. Magelsen's German roots explain why the family has the same last name throughout the plate. Kelly says the practice of using a permanent family name was uncommon in Norway at the time.
Their social custom was not to give children the same last name as their father. If their father's name was Lars, the children would be Lars' daughter or Larsen. So seeing that they refer to themselves as the family Magelsen would indicate to me that they have a cultural outlook that isn't typically Norwegian. Perhaps they had more experience with other cultures in Europe that have that permanent family last name.
However, the family still kept some Scandinavian naming traditions. The plate features a few different names multiple times: Hans Gunther Magelsen, Sarah Magelsen, and Christian Magelsen.
Names got used over and over and over again in Norwegian families. It was very common to name a child after their grandparent, and it wasn't unusual to have more than one child in a family that had the same name.
The value of this plaque, both a carefully crafted artisanal object and a sentimental record keeper, speaks of the dedication the Magelsens had to keeping Norwegian culture and their family history alive in the upper Midwest. Sending a family heirloom to America, a faraway country, with no practical purpose, reflects the journey of the Magelsen family.
Something like this would have been something that they could display freely without having to worry about discrimination and what it might mean to cling to the old country, so to speak.
By 1870, almost 60,000 Norwegians had settled in Wisconsin, and that included members of the Magelsen family. The United States became known as Vesterheim, or the Western Home.
Hee-Won Lim brought us that story on the Norwegian Geological Plaque, which is part of the Wisconsin Historical Society's collection. It's also a part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells the history of the state through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCullum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Picture your classic whodunit mystery, Agatha Christie style. There's been a murder. Six people with their own perspectives and agendas try to figure out which one of them done it.
But take it out of an English country house, please, and move it to a Wisconsin supper club. That's the premise of the new play, Murder Girl, currently running at the Overture Center in Madison.
I talked to two of the Wisconsin-made creators of the play last week. Heidi Armbruster is an actress and playwright from Wisconsin. Murder Girl is her latest play. And Jen Uphoff-Gray is the founding artistic director of Forward Theater Company. I started by asking Heidi about the Wisconsin influence behind her plays.
Oh, yeah. I went to high school in Wanakee, Wisconsin, and then am a graduate of University of Wisconsin-Madison. My dad actually worked for UW in the Department of Dairy Science, and then when he retired, he bought a farm in Lodi. So I spent a lot of time farm adjacent. And when I moved to New York, I had a real calling to sort of keep writing about where I was from, and particularly the agricultural themes that I was sort of familiar with. And at the same time that I was writing those things, I also had a real interest in murder mystery. So Murder Girl is sort of an attempt to bring those two worlds together, to write a murder mystery that's set in and around the people and the themes that I associate with the state of Wisconsin.
And Heidi, you're spot on. You've got it, I believe, set in a supper club. Tell us a little bit about Murder Girl.
Yeah. Murder Girl is a story about a family-run business that's been passed from one generation to the next. And the brother and sister are running it after their mother's passing. And a girl goes missing. And the chosen family that inhabits and keeps this world alive work to solve the mystery of the missing girl.
Jen, you are also from Wisconsin. You're directing the premiere run of Murder Girl. What spoke to you about this script and its connection to Wisconsin?
Well, as someone who, like Heidi, grew up around here, I was Oregon schools, not Wanakee, but close by. I always love a play that is specific, right? And whether the setting is specifically, you know, a rural Wisconsin supper club or an apartment in New York City or a beach somewhere, that specificity, I think, sometimes makes something universal. But the treat for our audiences to get to experience this story where the specifics are so close to home and so recognizable, just it was irresistible. And Heidi really knows her way around a mystery story. And she clearly knows all the details that make this Wisconsin setting so authentic. So the pairing of those two was just perfection.
And Jen, I understand you had the opening show last night, the first performance. How'd it go? What was the reaction?
Well, the audience loved it. We were packed to the walls. I don't know if it's the mystery genre, the supper club setting, the world premiereness of it all, the dynamite cast, whatever the reason, we have nearly sold out this run before our even first performance happened. It's very exciting to see full house there in the Playhouse. And the audience was just riding that ride with us. It's fun to hear people at the intermission trying to figure out who done it.
And the word who done it, I think, will conjure up one name for a lot of readers, Heidi, and that might be Agatha Christie. You are a fan. You, I believe, wrote a play about Agatha Christie. Talk about that connection you have to her work.
It was interesting. I had read a lot of Agatha Christie as a child, and I sort of put her in a box thinking like, oh, that's for old lady book clubs and middle school students. I was really dismissive of her as an adult. And then at a tough time in my life, I came back to them and I found Agatha Christie to be a very good friend. She's loyal and she's consistent and reliable. And her books, each chapter is sort of the length of a New York City subway ride. And she makes this contract with her reader where when you start, you know that at the end of the 250 pages, the world will have broken into chaos. But by the end of that time that you spend with her in her books, she will have organized that chaos and restored order to the world. And there was something just incredibly comforting to me about that formula. And I think it's one of the things that we as a, you know, murder mystery is kind of in, you know, having a cultural zeitgeist moment right now. And I have sort of suspected that it might be because of that, that we're all looking for a way to sort of organize the chaos. So in my mind, Agatha Christie is kind of patron saint of organizing chaos and making a puzzle and a game out of the solution.
We're talking about a new Wisconsin-themed whodunit play. It's called Murder Girl. Actor and playwright Heidi Armbruster is with us, and Jen Uphoff-Gray directing the premiere run of that show at Overture Center for the Arts. They're in the midst of that run. They're both from Wisconsin, by the way. Now, Heidi, when I think Agatha Christie, of course, I think British people or maybe a French person for a particular detective of hers.
Belgian.
Belgian. Oh, my goodness. I've just offended the great nation of Belgium. I apologize. Thank you for the correction. But these are Wisconsinites in an Agatha Christie-ish mystery. How did that change things? Did that change things?
Well, we had a dialect coach on the project. So there is some, and a lot of the dialect or the sort of rhythm of speech has been written into the text. And I think it's really fun to play with language and fun to play with the way that people speak and to really hear the rhythm of what a certain dialect can offer to the music of the play. And nobody on stage is an exact replica of anybody that I know, but the six people that we meet during the course of the play are all sort of variations, collections, kaleidoscopes of the people that I know in Wisconsin, both my family and my chosen family. They're familiar people to me. So I hope that that comes out in the writing of it too, that instead of using like these Agatha Christie archetypes, we're relying on people that we would meet if we went to Friday Night Fish Fry at our local.
And Jen, I'm glad both of you have these Wisconsin connections because I have seen Wisconsin portrayed in pop culture. And, you know, some stereotypes, some not fully formed notions of Midwestern people and identity. How important was it for you to have Heidi's characters be three-dimensional, not some sort of, you know, stereotypical Wisconsinite?
Well, I mean, that's the whole thing right there, right? I mean, I have read quite a few plays set in Wisconsin that were not written by Wisconsin people. And needless to say, we haven't produced any of them. There are tons of Wisconsin jokes in this play. There are so many wonderful Packers references and beer references and all the good things that we relish about our state character. But at no point is any of it poking fun. It is embracing and celebrating our culture the way, like I said earlier, you know, any really good specific play is about its own genre. I mean, we did joke at last night's talk back about the fact that when this play gets produced somewhere else, you know, we could see that someone might say, oh, and they all walk on wearing cheese heads. Yeah, no, there's none of that. And, you know, Heidi mentioned our wonderful dialect coach. We've got a great rural Wisconsin sound, but we aren't, again, it's not mocking it, it's celebrating it. It's not so heavy and, you know, let's make fun of people. Let's just enjoy what's special about this neck of the woods.
I want to get a little bit into the value of theater. You mentioned how reading Agatha Christie was some consolation for you in life, and that this idea of chaos and misunderstanding and finding order can be valuable to us in tumultuous times. Talk about that a little more. What does that mean to you in your work?
I think, yeah, I'm really interested in characters who are neither good nor bad. Like, all of the characters on stage do good things and do bad things, and so many of their faults are driven by their desire to love and protect the people that they care for. And I think that's complicated and nuanced. And I think there's something about understanding, maybe in each one of us, but maybe somehow in the national conversation too, that in our DNA, there's the potential for very good and the potential for very bad. And to put those two forces together in some kind of conversation that resolves into healing feels important right now.
And we'll leave it there. Heidi, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
And Jen, thanks for being with us.
A real pleasure. Thanks.
Heidi Armbruster is an actress and playwright from Wisconsin. Her latest play is called Murder Girl. It's running now at Madison's Overture Center. And director Jen Uphoff Gray is the founding artistic director of Forward Theater Company and a Wisconsin native herself. In addition to the live performances, there is an online filmed version of Murder Girl. It's going to be available to stream through November 24th. You can find info and tickets at overture.org. That's overture.org. And hey, any theater fans out there, we want to hear from you. What is the best play you've ever seen? Whether a big fancy production or maybe a local community or a high school play? Maybe you were in it. Tell us all about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
So my kittens, Zoe and Joey, they are adorable and they are naughty as ever. And they're definitely not ready for the meow main stage at the International Cat Show.
But an English setter named Lake Effect Alley in Lakeside in northern Wisconsin is racking up national wins as a cover dog hunting grouse. And we'll get to meet Alley's owner on a future program.
We'd love to see pictures and hear stories about your pet. Do you enter them in competitions? What sport do you like to do with your dog or another animal? And how did you get into it anyway?
Or do they just win the prize for the best pet in your house? Leave us a message or text us right now. The number is 888-642-0232. You can find that number at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. Maybe you could send along some pet pictures when you email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. CASA.org.
And thanks for sharing your four-legged family members with us.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.